Welcome to Mrigashira, a podcast that communicates with communicators. This podcast is a tribute to our fantastic fellow professionals, colleagues, and friends. I'm Chari Razada, and this podcast is brought to you in association with Digiderms. For many people and businesses, the word marketing invokes visions of pricey marketing strategies and excessive expenditure. However, it does not have to be expensive. There are plenty of cost-effective ways to market a business. So how do you engage with customers in a crowded marketplace with diminishing marketing spend and maximize the return on the marketing investment? Well, on Mrigashira, we have with us Jesse Paul, a marketing enthusiast, author, and board member to various listed companies. Her first book, No Money Marketing, From Upstart to Big Brand on a Frugal Budget, was based on her experience putting Indian brands on the global map. Her new book, Marketing Without Money, An Essential Guide, discusses how to build a brand for less in the digital era. Marketing Without Money is packed with tried and tested tools and techniques that have successfully worked. It's loaded with insights from business leaders, DIY charts, tables and pullouts, frugal tips, examples, and anecdotes for sharpening your marketing messages. Stay with me to know more with Jessie herself. Hello, Jessie. Pleasure having you on Mrigashira.
Hi, Chari. Thanks so much for having me.
No, congratulations on your second book, Marketing Without Money, An Essential Guide. Sounds like an impossible dream for marketeers. But before we come to understanding more about the book and the concept, let me ask you, as a marketer yourself, you know, you've seen so many changes in these last two decades. How have marketers adapted to this change world? Or if they are yet to, you know, come up to the speed as expected, or your views on that?
So marketers, generally speaking, will follow the eyeballs. So wherever the eyeballs are, you will see a marketer. So whether it was in the olden days where, you know, there was a sandwich board chasing you as you went shopping, or today now there is an eye tracker chasing you as you look at a screen, marketers are pretty good at finding their audience and chasing them. So that's one aspect of marketing which kind of stays the same. But if I look at the other aspects of marketing beyond awareness, they don't change all that much. So if I look at a cycle like AIDA, which is very common, awareness, interest, desire, and acquisition, the how you do it has changed, but not the actual cycle itself. So following the eyeballs, definitely they have embraced. Many have adapted to the fact that you can now sell directly to a lot of people who maybe don't buy a lot, maybe they buy one or two items. So that's a long tail. So the whole D2C industry is fueled by chasing the long tail. So earlier, if you had curly hair, I couldn't find you, and you know, I was burning a lot of money advertising on Chitrahar to, you know, sell just for curly hair. I would have to say this appeals to long hair and this one appeals to curly hair and this one is for those with gray hair. I had to fill it all out. But now I'm able to chase you down. You're probably a member of some Facebook group and so on, and I can chase you as a long tail. And market research, again, something that marketers have always wanted to do but was prohibitively expensive when you had to actually line up 100 people and talk to them. Now pretty much you could do it all the time because, you know, every time you're looking online, something pings you, and nowadays we call it, you know, real-time analytics. But the fact is it's nothing but market research. So I'm able to say 100 people like you like this thing, so you too will like it. So those aspects I think marketers have been pretty good at adapting to. The downside I think is that there is a lot of information out there. It looks as if you can do everything for free, but there is a lot of noise also out there. And what CEOs and marketers also have gone for, therefore, is, oh, you could do everything and it's all measurable. And unfortunately, not everything is measurable. And in this search for measurability, in this search for addressing every possible market, I think some marketers are actually running pretty inefficiently. So that's really my take on that.
So let me ask you a question here. And you talked about that, you know, it's really the rules of the game haven't really changed. And of course, it's the way we just new ways of doing some of those things and more access to information and research and all stuff. But isn't consumer behavior changing? Is it really the same what it used to be, say, 2 decades ago, or how it's evolved 1 decade ago? And then you have these so many new generations. They all are defined by different characteristics. So isn't there a challenge? It can't be one size fits all, right? So there has to be far more layers to it.
You know, people say I love frameworks, and that's because they seem to have universal truths. So one of the universal truths that I like is Maslow's hierarchy, which says that first, you go for the basics. You have to have your food, your security, your roof over your head in place. Then you talk about belonging. Then you talk about esteem. Then you talk about self-actualization. So all of this Gen Z, millennial, all of that is all very well. But really, it is because they're starting at different levels of the Maslow's hierarchy. So when we talk Gen Z or millennial, we are talking about people who are somewhat well off. We are not talking about someone who is scavenging for a living or struggling to put food on the table, because they behave a lot like anybody else around the world who's struggling to put food on the table. So I think a better way to look at India, frankly, and we've never done this categorization, is pre-liberalization, post-liberalization, and what I would call liberalization's babies are those who were born, let's say, 95 onwards. Right now, they behave differently, and again, not the whole world but a large cohort, because they have been part of an optimistic arising India. They see a future that is better than the past. Until recently, at least until the COVID pandemic, that would have been true. And so that definitely changes your behavior, because I'm more likely to take risks, I'm more likely to spend on cosmetics, I'm more likely to buy white goods because I can afford it or I feel it's a necessity, I'm less likely to buy a car. So I start acting like cohorts in other countries with similar income, similar needs. But it all boils down to Maslow's hierarchy. Where am I? And again, it's in slices, right? So someone just wants a roof over their head. Somebody else says, oh, if I have 2 kids, I cannot manage under 3 bedrooms. So the roof over the head starts to enlarge a bit. Somebody else says, oh, I can't survive without a second home in that country or whatever. But it's still on the hierarchy, and that doesn't change no matter how you look at it. So I don't believe our behavior has changed. So one is where we start has changed. The starting point has changed. The second is, in some ways, I was always, you know, we've always talked about keeping up with the Joneses, right? So, or Onida, which came with the neighbor's envy. Now, in the past, I actually physically had to see my neighbor with an Onida to get inspired by that. Or it was, you know, so-and-so has that car, I need it. The advantage of social media is that I can have FOMO without ever seeing this person. I just need to see it on Instagram or whatever to get that FOMO. Say, oh, but everybody's got this, right? And so much so that, like, I was in Singapore and my daughter wanted to wear a sweater. And I'm like, nobody wears sweaters out here. Are you crazy? But you go to H&M in Singapore and they sell sweaters just like around the world. And an H&M basically makes it fashionable for you to wear a sweatshirt, regardless of whether you live in equatorial Singapore or in Bangalore or in Delhi or whatever. So there's this whole audience of, you know, 13 to 16 year olds who are walking around in what H&M believes they should wear. Now, to do this in pre-digital era was tough. Now you can just say, across the world, I have decided you all can wear sweatshirts. And I don't really care about your weather. And I can use social media to sell you the said thing. So that's, I think, the acceleration that we see, is that anything that relies on feedback, anything that relies on peer pressure, anything that relies on envy, that can be condensed. So the selling cycle can be shortened a great deal. The aspiration cycle can be shortened a great deal. I can make changes on the fly. So speed has definitely changed. Velocity has changed. But my basic desires are the same ones.
Interesting you talk about Maslow's hierarchy, and probably is this also why you talk around the line, particular line you use about the first gig is for money and the second for fame and third for influence and fourth for joy. It kind of reminds me of our life, which is according to the ancient texts, which says, you know, life consists of infancy, youth, middle years and old age, but each stage is an important and beautiful time of growth, learning, caring, sharing kind of a thing. But coming back to the point you make, why should every stage not be for joy and the rest, money, fame, influence, can all follow, right?
So one of my bosses told me that the purpose of working is to be able to control your own destiny. And the closer you get to that, the happier you are in your workspace. And the example he gave was stuff like, okay, you have to go out at lunch for a dentist appointment or whatever. Do you have to ask somebody or can you just go? And he said, it's all these tiny, tiny things that add up to making you feel empowered and independent and all of that stuff. So if I look at it that way, when you start your career, unless, you know, you are lucky enough to be an Isha Ambani and you start at a certain level and they say you're working through the ranks, but let's face it, you have a dental appointment, you can leave, right? You tend to have to put up with certain irritations because you need the money. And, you know, we always say, oh, you know, bad bosses is what make you leave, true enough. But I don't leave because even if the boss is bad, I don't know if I can get another job and I have EMIs to pay. I cannot do it. So people did question the order and I put it because for me, I needed the money first. Without the money, I couldn't take certain calls. And it is true that I did do one flirtation without much money, but I couldn't afford a house on that income. I mean, so much so that my boss had to lend me money to pay for the deposit for our first apartment because it was 20,000 bucks and we did not have 20,000 bucks in hand. So the order was really saying that you take care of your basic, whatever you say is the basics there. Then you can go for the other stuff. And again, you could switch around the influence and the fame. But those two for me add up to credibility. So if you don't want to be like the other 1 million job seekers on LinkedIn, you do need the fame and the influence. Otherwise, you know, for every job, there are another million people standing around. So if you've published or you've spoken or someone has recognized you, I think that definitely helps. And the joy comes when you're able to have the confidence that you're really good at what you do. And you have a fair amount of autonomy because people also realize that you're really good at what you do. Or you're an entrepreneur, but you're not going to starve if your company fails. That gives you a lot of joy as well. So, you know, that I think is why I put that string together in that order. And I recognize that if you're a 20-year-old living at home, sure, you're probably pursue the fame and the influence and the joy. If you're somebody who's not looking for material wealth, you could start with joy, not an issue. My sequencing was based on the corporate ladder and what I think would work if you had to actually rise up in the Maslow's hierarchy.
No, I agree with you. I mean, money is the first thing. What I was kind of referring to the fact that why can we not work, pursue our passions and work, what gives us joy and happiness and money along with it. But then that's an idealistic world.
This was something I played around with, I think, 2008 or 2009 with Rama Bijapurkar. Jim Collins has a model called the 3 P's. So the 3 P's is a little Venn diagram and it is the passion, the perfection and the profitability. And he used it in the organization context. Now it has been labeled as Ikigai and it's for a personal concept. It's the same stuff. And you have to find something that you're passionate about. It's something that you can be really good at and something which can feed you. And that's your sweet spot. What most of us find is that you could be truly passionate about something. You could even be really good at something. But is it going to pay you enough to feed you is where for a lot of us it doesn't click. So I like my newsletter. I think I write a very good newsletter. But newsletters is not a space where you make millions.
So coming to the book, so in this day and age when everything is being commercialized, and if we were to talk in the context of startups or an MSME, every penny spent on marketing has a trade-off. So as it could have potentially been used for something else to boost sales, perhaps, or to the sales team, share with us the secret you've used of marketing without money.
So the secret, okay, I mean, you've got to buy the book, otherwise, what's the...
Absolutely, yes.
The books.
Yes, yes.
Right? So I just give techniques on, and the levers are simple. So despite digital, the most expensive part of marketing continues to be awareness. So whether you're doing print advertising or you're doing digital advertising, it still is the biggest part of your expenses. So if you want to market without money, I think one very important step is to reduce your target audience to the bare minimum. And of course you can, you know, grow it as you get more money. But if you're not a funded startup, make it as small as possible. So like I said, you want to launch a hair care line. Maybe you start with a niche that is underserved, like the curly hair market, or you know, the beard company was a great example. They just went after men with beards. You start that way and then you can go mainstream. So step one is to really narrow down your target audience. The second, which I say, is that you want to optimize whatever messaging you take to market. And we humans generally can't remember anything except the best in the space. So there are fancier words for it, like top of mind recall. Like if I say toothpaste, what comes to your mind? If I say hair care, what comes to your mind? Or if I say computers, which one comes to your mind? But generally, we remember the superlative. So we remember the only XYZ. And so for every product or service that you want to take to market, you need to find that superlative for yourself. And it's also about the niche. So maybe, you know, Amul owns the dairy space, so you can't really fight and say I'm India's best dairy producer or biggest. But people have made an entry by saying we are the only guys who provide A2, or I'm the only one offering organic or free range. So you can always find a niche in which you are number one and you own the superlative. So I think step two is to find that superlative. And the third, of course, is something which, you know, so I worked in Infosys in the early days, and Mr. Murthy was really, really good actually at marketing. So one of his lines was marketing is about being interesting. And if you can't be interesting, then nobody wants to talk about you. So all that paid stuff also, you still have to be interesting. So I think those are the three big principles, which is just narrow your target audience, find yourself a superlative, even if it's really small. And third, don't be afraid to do interesting things.
No, absolutely. And with so much of clutter around us, it's only the interesting things which catch people's attentions, right? So amongst multiple threats of an ongoing recession and giving world leaders and businesses sleepless nights, budgets are going to be closely guarded. So in such a scenario, do you see an increased role of for digital in marketing as a brand savior?
So digital is a savior only for those whose audience is entirely digital. Otherwise, you know, there's no difference between print and digital in that, look, if my audience is reading print, I cannot just count on digital to save me.
But isn't largely the audience which businesses target is digital today? While they may be having interest in print, but they would be in some way on digital too.
They may or may not be, because again, it depends who you're targeting. So I was on a market visit. I'm on the board of a company called Credit Access Grameen. And the audience there makes maybe a lakh or two a year. So they are technically Indians middle class. they are not on digital in the way we think. I mean, they do have a phone, they are able to do phone banking and so on, but they are not what you think is a digital audience, nor even are they really a print audience, right? They watch TV, they look at billboards, they travel on buses, right? So I think it's all a question of being careful about avoiding waste and going to the place where your eyeballs are more likely to be there. Second, which today is kind of considered old-fashioned, but was definitely something we used to do, is if you build a brand, then when a recession comes and you go dark, people will still buy you. So a Colgate doesn't advertise for 6 months, I'll still go buy their toothpaste. Because, you know, they own that position in my head. They are the superlative owner. There are plenty of products that I buy which I've never seen an ad, right? But I go by the product, it's available, and I have a positive, you know, notion about it. So I think more than digital saving you, I think it is a question of, have you invested in a brand? Do you know what's the medium that your audience can do? Are you able to manage your distribution? Because today it is actually, so digital is like, you know, maybe 2000 or 20 or something. But now it's not just digital. Can you reach it to me in my PIN code within a day or 20 minutes, whatever it is that I've decided? Like my daughter really doesn't believe that you have to order beforehand. I need shampoo, okay? I'll order. No, I mean, like, I'm going for a shower now. Can it come before that? You know, so the thing is that, can I get that shampoo to you right now? And she doesn't go with digital. She goes with influencers. I went for a sleepover. I tried this person's shampoo. It was really nice. Now, went for a shower. Get it from me. So we have to control the delivery supply chain. That actually can also be a huge winner in recession. The third is the customer experience. So one of the brands I love is Urban Company. And they don't need to advertise. I'm hooked. And the reason is they have thought about so many little moments of truth within the cycle. So if I called him for repair, he brought the spare part beforehand. And then when it was required, he pulled it out, showed me the wrapping, showed it worked, showed me the old one. He went to a lot of trouble to establish the trust in the process. The cleaning guys dragged me upstairs, come and see, look, I have done under the bed, everything, right? Now, that's what gives Urban Club, without advertising, it will still get repeat business, right? So they've got their app on the phone, they have a good diversity, but it's also the last mile. They're able to crack the last mile. Indigo can advertise all it likes, but in my moment of truth, it did not deliver. And therefore, it has lost a bit in my brand because, I mean, I was on Twitter, I was there in person, I was calling. I did not get a response to a very simple problem which we had, which was fast forward not working because I hadn't paid for the onward journey. But it was a very simple thing, but it's damaged my brand that no advertising is going to cure in a hurry, right? And that's being reinforced when you read the paper and you hear that, oh, well, you know, half their flights were late on a Saturday. And earlier I'd have been, oh, my God, could that happen? And now it's like, yeah, that sounds about right. So, you know, your position has changed. So if I look at recession, I think first they should invest in the brand and not tally everything to some benefit in terms of sales. Everything does not lead to sales in the short term. Invest a little bit in the long term. But if they haven't done so, not too late to focus on A, narrowing down the reach, B, finding that story that really engages and thrills your audience, and then translating that into amazing delivery, because it's not just the brands tightening the budget, people are tightening their budget. And then not just the money, I just want the reassurance that if I'm going to spend money on this thing, it's going to actually work.
Thank you so much for sharing those wonderful tips. And I'm going to urge all the listeners of Megashira to really go out and pick up Marketing Without Money, an essential guide, if they want to know more. I'm going to pick up this book because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interesting things which I could learn from. Thank you so much, Jessie, for joining.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thanks, Charu.
Bye.
Hope you enjoy listening to Megashira, a podcast for communication folks. Do share your suggestions and feedback on Mrigashira at digitales.co.in. Have a great week ahead, and do not forget to tune in next week. Adios.